Tracks Across the Desert. James Strobridge and Charlie Crocker had been waiting for the day they would begin leading their crews across the flat Nevada landscape, but what they quickly discovered was that setting down rails in Nevada meant meeting the challenges of a vast and uninhabitable desert. It meant toiling in a region described by one early traveler as a purely arid plain covered with sagebrush, varied by white alkali flats, holding but little water and that bad, with hot springs here and there, lizards and jackrabbits the principal inhabitants, land with absolutely no timber. It meant coping with conditions as different as possible from those they had endured in the mountains. In the Nevada desert, the workers were forced to haul their heavy rails, wield their huge sledgehammers, and lug wheelbarrow after wheelbarrow in temperatures that rose to 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Water was transported in huge wooden tanks on flat cars and had to be conserved. Just as Cape Horn and the Summit Tunnel had taken their human toll, the Nevada desert would exact its own price. Hundreds of workers collapsed on the line, and scores of others came close to death from heat stroke and dehydration. With the mountains behind them, Strobridge would allow no slowdown in the work. This was the opportunity to make up for lost time, the chance to lay down more miles of track than the Union Pacific. As one astounded observer, gazing at the activity around the CP's construction train, wrote, "Long lines of horses, mules, and wagons were standing in the open desert near the camp train. The livestock was getting its breakfast of hay and barley. Foremen were galloping here and there on horseback, giving or receiving orders. Swarms of laborers, Chinese, Europeans, and Americans, were hurrying to their work. On one side of the track stood the movable blacksmith shop, where a score of blacksmiths were repairing tools and shoeing horses and mules. To the west were the rails, stretching back as far as the eye could reach. To the eastward stretched the grade marked by a line of newly distributed earth. By the side of the grade smoked the campfires of the blue-clad laborers who could be seen in groups waiting for the signal to start work. These were the Chinese, and the job of this particular contingent was to clear a level roadbed for the track. They were the vanguard of the construction forces. Miles back was the camp of the rear guard, the Chinese who followed the track gang, finishing the roadbed." Aside from the frenzied activity, something else was taking place in Nevada as well. "As I was moving my outfit forward, after having been placed in charge as engineer of construction on the building of the road eastward from the California-Nevada state line," Joseph M. Graham later wrote, "I measured and staked out what was later to be the city of Reno. It would be the first of a number of communities that, thanks to the CP, would eventually blossom in the desert." Founding Reno. Reno, Nevada had the distinction of being the first town founded as the Central Pacific began to make its way across the mostly barren Nevada desert. Reno's earliest development began well before the CP graders and track layers appeared in the area. In 1859, the first major discovery of silver ore in the United States, known as the Comstock Lode, took place. Almost immediately after the discovery was made, Charles Fuller built a log bridge over the Truckee River near the site of present-day Reno and charged a toll to silver seekers crossing over to get to the mining area. The next year, Fuller built a hotel and a restaurant. In 1861, Fuller sold his holdings to Myron Lake, who named the spot Lake's Crossing. Some 6 years later, when it became clear that his property stood in the path of oncoming Central Pacific tracks, Lake saw an opportunity to increase his business prospects. Realizing that a railroad station on the site of his land would bring more people to his hotel and restaurant, he made a deal with Charles Crocker. Under the terms of their agreement, Lake gave a section of his land, large enough for the tracks to be laid upon it, to the Central Pacific. In return, the CP erected a railroad depot. Lake was not alone in recognizing the opportunities created by a railroad operating in the vicinity of the Comstock Lode. Crocker was also convinced that any town that arose in the area, particularly one with its own depot, was bound to flourish. No one is certain who gave Reno its name. Some claim that it was Joseph Graham who laid it out. Others say it was Crocker. What is known is that it was named for Civil War hero General Jesse Lee Reno, who died while leading Union troops at the Battle of South Mountain. What is also true is that Crocker's belief in the future of the town was well realized, and that Reno, a town carved out of the desert, not only thrived, but grew into a community that today proudly calls itself the biggest little city in the world. By this time, the Central Pacific's Chinese laborers had become among the quickest railroad construction workers in the world. But nothing was ever fast enough for Strobridge. And in the middle of the desert, he came up with a new and quicker way of laying track by doubling both the number of men setting down the ties and the number of men fastening the rails to them, and giving them the room to do it more rapidly than ever. Under his new system, a first group of workers placed every other tie. This group was immediately followed by a second gang of tie setters who placed the rest. Once the track layers set the rails on the ties, a first gang of spikers drove in every other spike. They were quickly followed by a second group of spikers who completed the spiking job. To save more time, Strobridge came up with yet another strategy. Whenever his crews came to a ravine or other obstacle that called for the time-consuming task of building a bridge, he had them skirt the area by laying their tracks in snake-like curves, often for miles around it. It was a strategy that particularly pleased the CP's directors. Every extra mile of track laid meant more money in their pockets. Thanks in great part to Strobridge's new measures, the Central Pacific, for the first time since laying its initial rails, was moving forward as quickly as the Union Pacific had in crossing the Great Plains. 2 and 3 mile track laying days became common. In July and August 1868 alone, 46 miles of track were laid, inspiring an Alta California reporter to write, "The track laying site that knew the CP in the morning knew it no more at night. It was nearly 10 miles off, while a smooth, well-built, compact roadbed for traveling stretched from the morning site to evening stopping place." A San Francisco newsman was equally impressed. "Taking out my watch," he wrote, "I timed the last half mile I saw laid, and it took a little less than 28 minutes." From September to the end of December 1868, the CP's crews continued setting rails at the same rapid pace they had established after Strobridge had begun driving them across Nevada. By the end of 1868, they had, in that year, laid almost 370 miles of track. The Central Pacific was now at the Utah border. The men of the Union Pacific were also racing toward the Utah line. After working their way over almost 1,000 miles of mostly flat terrain, they were about to encounter something totally different. They had reached Sherman Summit, which sat atop the vital pass Grenville Dodge had discovered in 1865, while fleeing from a band of Native Americans. Dodge had named it for his friend and former military colleague William T. Sherman. At an altitude of 8,640 feet, it was more than 1,000 feet higher than the peak through which the Central Pacific had constructed its summit tunnel. William Tecumseh Sherman, the man for whom Sherman Summit was named, stated that the building of the Transcontinental Railroad would require the work of giants. And Sherman would turn out to be one of the greatest giants of them all, by providing more moral and physical support for the railroad's construction than anyone outside the rail companies. In 1849, as a young Army lieutenant, he conducted the only survey seeking a possible railroad route through the Sierras. But Sherman received almost no recognition for this preliminary survey. 12 years later, however, he would begin to gain enormous fame as a Union general in the Civil War. In 1862 and 1863, as a Union general, Sherman served under Ulysses S. Grant and played a key role in the capture of the Confederate stronghold at Vicksburg. In 1864, after taking command of all Union forces in the Western Theater, he led his troops on a march that resulted in the capture of Atlanta and its railroad yards, a decisive turning point in the war. After the Civil War ended, Sherman remained in the service, and in 1869, when Grant became President of the United States, he succeeded him as Commanding General of the Army. He remained in that post until 1884. His support for the Transcontinental Railroad remained strong throughout his years at the top of the Union Army Command. Sherman arranged for Grenville Dodge's release from the Army so that he could become a driving force of the Union Pacific. He persuaded his brother, who was a U.S. senator, to foster and promote legislation in support of the Transcontinental. And beginning in 1868, he posted more than 5,000 soldiers along the tracks to protect the railroad workers from Indian attacks. The Sherman summit may have been higher, but fortunately for the UP, it presented none of the challenges that the Central Pacific had faced in making its way through the Sierra Nevada. There was nothing like Cape Horn, around which the CP had to build an unprecedented type of ledge to hold its tracks. There was nothing like the monstrous granite peak through which the Central Pacific had constructed its summit tunnel. By April 16, 1868, Casement's men had succeeded in laying their rails through what would be not only the highest point on the Transcontinental Railroad, but the highest of any railroad in the world. Among those most impressed with the feat was a writer employed by the Union Pacific. "Sherman is gained," he wrote, "and the traveler stands as near heaven as the Union Pacific Railroad approaches. The rarefied atmosphere allows the blood to course freely through the veins. The spirits rise, the eye is ravished, the senses are astonished. Here the waters of the continent divide. In one direction they start on their long journey to the Atlantic. In the other, they tumble down the Pacific slope." To celebrate his company's having built the highest railroad in the world, Tom Durant traveled all the way from New York to help set the final rail. The UP leader was so pleased with the achievement that he could not resist sending a telegram to CP President Leland Stanford, bragging about what the UP had done. Stanford wired back his congratulations, stating, "We cheerfully yield you the palm of superior elevation. 7,242 feet has been quite sufficient to satisfy our highest ambition." Stanford, however, could not resist adding another line with an obvious double meaning. "May your descent be rapid," he wrote. An even greater challenge than Sherman's summit was faced by special work crews of Casement's army. At the same time that the rails were being laid through the summit, UP bridge builders were engaged in one of the most treacherous and exhausting undertakings of all. At a towering canyon at Dale Creek in Wyoming Territory, UP engineers and crews had to build a 650-foot-long bridge over the creek that flowed 150 feet below. Constructing a bridge of that length made of wood and strong enough to enable locomotives and long lines of rail cars to pass over it while the ever-present Wyoming winds whipped through the canyon was difficult to imagine. Timber for the immense structure had to be felled in the Michigan woods and shipped to Chicago, where it was cut to specifications. The wood was transported by rail across a temporary bridge over the Missouri River, and then finally carried along UP's tracks from Omaha to the building site. The bridge builders were forced to risk their lives as they worked high above the canyon in strong winds on what one historian has called a structure of interlaced toothpicks. When the bridge was completed, government inspectors refused to approve it unless the Union Pacific promised that within a year it would replace the structure with an iron bridge supported by steel cables. The UP kept its promise, but until it did, the Dale Creek Bridge struck terror into the hearts of all the train travelers who ventured across it. But the UP could justifiably boast that it had constructed the highest railroad bridge in the world. And precarious though it was, there was no question that, like the CP's building of the Summit Tunnel, it was one of the 19th century's greatest engineering feats. With the Sherman Summit and the Dale Creek Bridge behind him, Casement's next goal was the Utah border. "I have never been hurried up more in my life," he wrote to his wife, telling her that he and his foreman intended to lay over 3 miles of track every day. They not only did that, they often surpassed it. Their only slowdowns came when they reached the Wyoming desert, where at times the temperatures soared to more than 100 degrees by day and fell to freezing at night. Yet despite the fact that scores of mules died from both heat and cold, and the parched workmen were slowed down waiting for the special water trains that ran up and down the line, they kept moving on. So rapidly, in fact, that in August alone they laid a record 65 miles of rail. It was still not enough for Casement. In September, motivated by additional bonuses, his men on several occasions laid between 4 and 5 miles in a day. The work was now continuing until midnight, with evening crews laboring by the light of bonfires. Late in October, with the tops of the water barrels now rimmed with ice, the end of the UP's tracks were within a few miles of the Utah line. The two great railroad companies that had started out half a continent away from each other were now less than 500 miles apart.